should the U.S. intervene in Syria? Behind that one question are several more. Questions that also concern the U.S. role in world affairs, the strength of evidence tying chemical weapons use to Syrian President Assad, and whether going into Syria now goes too far or not far enough. The discussion could go on for days. We will take just an hour on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and I'll be talking with defense reporter Juana Summers of Politico and political science professors Ryan Hendrickson of Eastern Illinois University and Fred Lawson of Mills College. Your questions and comments are welcome, too, on Focus on WYLL. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. It's been just about 2.5 weeks since the UN Security Council met to consider those first reports of chemical weapons killing hundreds of civilians in Syria. While it's not involved in a later agreement, since then we have had a flurry of action and a flurry of debate, but yet no resolution to the question of whether the United States should be stepping in to take military action in Syria. That is something that the president is trying to convince Congress to give permission to do, although the president says he does not actually need Congress's permission, and he has not said what he'll do if Congress does not give that permission. The president is now at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg, Russia, where he is not finding unanimous support among the G20 nations for going into Syria. And he has just announced this morning that he will address the American people on Tuesday to make his case for military action. We're going to try to figure all of this out in an hour. That shouldn't be too difficult because we have some smart people with us on Focus today to help us look at the problem. And for the first few minutes, we'll be talking with Juana Summers. She's a defense reporter at Politico. And Juana, welcome to Focus.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
And if Congress took a vote now, today, on President Obama's request to take military action in Syria, how would it go?
It wouldn't go very well for the president. We've been speaking to a lot of leadership aides on both sides of the aisle, and they both say that President Obama does not have enough support, even within the 200 House Democrats in the House, to get this through Congress. So the chances are not looking good. So what the administration can do over the next few days to encourage members of Congress to get their confidence will be critical.
Why is Congress not moving along with the president? Is it how much of it is their own particular feelings on it? How much of it is what they're hearing from their constituents?
There's no doubt that what lawmakers are hearing from their constituents is playing a great deal. We've been watching tapes from a number of town halls across the country as many lawmakers are still back in their districts. And what you're seeing in liberal districts, conservative districts, is a nation that is weary of war and does not want intervention. A recent ABC News, Washington Post poll showed that 60% of Americans surveyed said that they do not support military intervention in Syria, despite the fact that we've heard strong rhetoric from the administration, from the president himself, and as well as the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, making the case that these alleged chemical attacks are absolutely unacceptable and a huge humanitarian crisis.
This seems like such a reversal of a decade ago, where Congress gave strong support for going into action in the Mideast after the 9/11 attacks, where really the criticism against opponents bordered on questioning patriotism. But things have really changed since then.
They have. This is an extraordinarily different vote, and I think that some of the shadows of Iraq and Afghanistan and the authorization for the use of military force vote there are coming into play. You've heard lawmakers, particularly anti-war Democrats, challenge that vote back in 2001 in the days following 9/11 and say that it was taken too hastily. And I think that that's playing into the conscience of many lawmakers. They want more information and more details, and that's why you've seen the administration over the last couple of days start reaching out to lawmakers. The president and his senior staff are making calls. There have been classified and as well as unclassified appearances on the Hill by top national security members of the administration. So they've really got to make the case, given the shadow of Iraq and Afghanistan is kind of lingering.
Is there a partisan tinge to opposition and support, or is it going across party lines, both the support and the opposition to the president's proposal?
Look, if you look at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee vote as a test case, this is not a partisan issue. That committee voted 10-7 to move ahead with the resolution to use force in Syria. But you had Democrats and Republicans on both sides of that vote, from Libertarian Rand Paul to John McCain, two people who were at very different ideological sides of the debate. So this certainly is not a partisan issue. The president is finding some allies among Republicans who are defense hawks who you don't traditionally see cleave to the president, including Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who is a Iraq and Afghanistan veteran. But he's also finding opposition within his own party from those who just say they're not ready to vote to authorize another war, that they see this as opening the door for long-standing United States intervention and attachment to the region.
You know, this might be a good place to start listening to some of the voices of the Illinois congressional delegation. And I want to look at a couple of people in Illinois who, first of all, in favor. And one of them is of course, a very well-known Senate Democrat, and that is Dick Durbin. We're going to listen to a little bit of audio here about his support for military action in Syria.
And I hope that the message comes through from this committee meeting and the floor of the Senate and the House that this Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are resolute when it comes to discouraging and stopping the spread of chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction. If the United States did not take this leadership role, I don't know who would. I do want to say that I take very seriously the president's promise that we will not be putting boots on the ground in Syria. I have been to too many funerals, visited too many disabled veterans to ever want to see us do that again, except when absolutely necessary for America's survival. I think that what we've done today is a step in the right direction. I hope that it makes it a safer world.
And that's Senator Dick Durbin speaking at the Senate committee meeting the other day. The resolution that came out of that committee is carefully worded and in some ways pretty narrowly worded as to what they want Obama to do.
I mean, it absolutely is. And what you kind of heard Dick Durbin say is that, in his earlier remarks, is that this is different from Iraq. This resolution is narrowly worded to avoid the so-called boots on the ground, which is what a lot of people fear will happen. That's also something that Secretary of State John Kerry tried to tamp down, the president has as well, that this isn't looking at like a ground conflict. The Pentagon is mostly focusing on missile strikes, as well as reported this morning a likely air strikes that would be in conjunction with the French military.
Okay, and I'm wondering, I understand there was also some language added to it, I think with the backing of Senator John McCain, which actually looks forward to something more in terms of a resolution of the larger conflict in Syria. Is that the case?
Absolutely. The resolution that passed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee included language that kind of to assuage the concerns of McCain and some others on the committee, that it's something called a sense of Congress language that would talk about kind of what the end point is in Syria, as opposed to just saying these are the military options we have and this is what we're going to do. The concern has been with a lot of members that by engaging in Syria, even in such a limited fashion, it could lead to a war without end, an unentangled conflict. And the McCain language is hoping to stave off that. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not that amendment survives as this language then goes to the Senate floor, likely early next week, and then passes on into the House where President Obama and this resolution will face a lot more opposition.
Okay. I'm noticing that also, at least at this point, military action is getting the support from Illinois' other senator, and that is Mark Kirk, who wrote on his Facebook page that the Syria resolution authorizes limited action with no boots on the ground, and with Iran watching, I will join Senator Dick Durbin in supporting it. Those were his words on Wednesday. But Senator Kirk does have some concerns that we could hear a little bit in this piece of audio.
I'm worried that there's apparently only one allied country supporting. Normally, when the United States does a military operation, we have a lot more allies.
I'm wondering, since voter opposition to this seems to be driving so much of the congressional opposition, it sounds like any work the president can do to promote the need for this military action is going to drive any success he has in getting congressional approval. But he's supposed to give a speech to the American people on Tuesday, but can that make much of a difference in terms of the popular sentiment?
It could make some difference. I don't think it's likely to have the sweeping effect that the administration would likely hope for. You have to remember that earlier on, about a week ago, Obama administration aides were rejecting the idea of doing any kind of big speech like this, and it might have been more effective then. Now I think the focus of the speech will be answering that what-if question. What if this resolution fails? What if he didn't get support from Congress? And remarks that the president made over just the last couple of minutes at the G20, he said that he thinks that he'll be able to get Congress to approve a resolution, but he wouldn't really entertain the possibility of what happens then. He said that he wasn't going to give a direct response to how he would act if, in fact, Congress does not support this resolution, given the steep chances it had and the number of folks on both sides of the aisle who don't seem to support it.
Well, having asked permission, if he doesn't get it, does that put the president in a lot of trouble if he goes ahead and orders a military strike anyway?
I think that it creates a huge problem for the Obama administration's foreign policy moving forward for the next 2 years of his term. While, of course, he doesn't face re-election again, it certainly, with battles looming in Congress like the fiscal cliff, the debate over the across-the-board sequestration cuts, it definitely weakens his hand and shows that he has no ability to wrangle congressional lawmakers. So this could be a big problem both for foreign policy and domestic, and also set a precedent for foreign conflicts moving forward, both in this administration and those in years to come.
Well, Juana, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today on Focus. Juana Summers is the defense reporter at Politico. This is going to be a very busy next few days for you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. You're listening to Focus on WYLL, and we are talking about Syria and the president's call for military action in Syria. We're going to move on to our next guests. And they are Ryan Hendrickson. He's a professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University on the phone with us. And also for a little later in the show for more on the situation in the Mideast and in Syria, Fred Lawson. He teaches international relations and government at Mills College in Oakland, California. Professor Hendrickson, welcome to Focus. And Mr. Lawson, also welcome to Focus as well.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having us.
Okay. Professor Hendrickson, if I could start to you, we're looking at, first of all, there are constitutional questions involved here in terms of who has the power to make war if what we are talking about is making war. We're not talking about a declaration of war. The president's and his cabinet have not even been talking about toppling President Assad's government. They just want to do something to stop the use of chemical weapons. Who has the power to do this, in constitutionally speaking?
Well, in my view, the president always needs to return to Congress to gain authorization and to gain approval to use force. The Constitution was based on some very simple principles of checks and balances. And the Founding Fathers felt that in any occasion, other than the case when a president is responding to repel a sudden attack, under all other conditions, the Congress is supposed to be the one to authorize the use of force. So I was very pleased to see Obama turn to Congress to request its approval in this case.
But there have been instances in the last few decades where presidents have taken military action without seeking congressional permission.
Indeed, that's true. And really since the aftermath of the Second World War, we've seen presidents increasingly make the case that they are the decision makers when it comes to determining if we're going to use force. That happened because with the onset of the Cold War, many in Congress and many in the American public agreed that the Soviet Union and its allies posed a serious threat, if not a military threat, to the United States. And when you have a clearly defined, you know, what was thought at the time as enemy, what need then do you have to check the president? So Congress, really beginning with the Korean War, and really for much of the next 60 years, in my view, has really abdicated its responsibility to check the president, which has worked to empower the president, and presidents have at the same time helped make the case that, look, I'm the one who's going to decide whether or not we're going to use force. And in fact, George W. Bush said that famous line saying, I am the decider. But if he's the only one that's the decider, there's really no checks and balances. So Obama will face a very interesting political condition here if Congress would, or excuse me, if the House would vote no on a use of force. I suspect the Senate will, but the House, you know, we don't know yet, like Juana's nice summary that she provided.
Well, you know, this brings back to a larger question, and when you compare it to World War II, when Congress did declare war on other countries, none of these other military actions, including the ones with the backing of Congress, have involved declarations of war, which is the language in the Constitution that where congressional authorization is mentioned. It's mentioned about declaring war. Is that some sort of magic phrase, declaring war, as compared to authorizing military action?
Well, it's a phrase that the president is very careful not to use, as you noted just a little bit earlier. If he does use that term, then it would automatically sort of trigger a duty for Congress to respond. But Congress, on many occasions, on a few occasions, has still authorized at least the use of force, as it did, you know, in the lead-up to Iraq, and as it did prior to the war in Afghanistan. So there are cases when Congress has made, you know, votes on whether or not to use force. But see, presidents don't like to use that term, nor does Congress, because if Congress starts talking about war, then they have to accept their constitutional responsibility to vote on that. And it is much easier not to vote on that, because then the political responsibility all will rest with the president. And so if the mission goes poorly, a member of Congress can say, well, look, this is the president's fault, not mine. And that's we've seen that in the past, and I suspect we'll continue to see that language of avoiding that war phrase.
We're talking about Syria, of course, and whether or not the U.S. is going or should be going in there. I'm talking right now with Ryan Hendrickson, professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. If you have questions or comments about Syria, give us a call. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. I'm wondering when there is one formal resolution out there that's passed a Senate committee, and that really is fairly narrow, but then also far-reaching with a sort of the sense of Congress language in there about an ultimate resolution to the situation in Syria. What context does that provide for any congressional approval of action in Syria?
Well, in the debate over Kosovo in 1999, there was a similar resolution passed by the Senate, which authorized the use of air power, but also said no boots on the ground. So in that respect, there's some similarity. But this little McCain addendum that he has also allows for a much wider interpretation of how the president potentially could use force. So if that part of the resolution goes forward and passes the full Senate, I think that's going to cause much greater problems for the vote to be successful in the House of Representatives.
Okay. I want to take a call now. We're going to go to line one, and this is good morning, Paul, from Champaign County. You're on Focus.
Hi. Yeah. I wanted to leave the mechanics of the passage or non-passage of this to go back to the story it's incontrovertible that the government used this stuff, and I want to introduce a number of things. One of the mysteries of this thing is that the Gouda victims, it's despicable, but they actually don't show signs of sarin gas to a large extent. Now, I'm not saying sarin hasn't been used, and there are reports that the Syrian rebels were smuggling it in. It was confiscated at the Turkish border. That goes back to June. But there's a munition called a fuel air explosion that actually is also called an asphyxiation bomb because it actually burns all the air out of a whole area, and people die of suffocation. And that would be a better explanation for these deaths, since there's no vomiting, there's no other signs on a lot of these victims. It's a hideous weapon, but one of the drawbacks of using it is that the U.S. has used it in shock and awe, and probably subsequently. I wanted to put that in the mix because it's not being discussed. I have no brief for the Russian government, the Syrian government, but I think we're U.S. citizens, and we need to know what the U.S. is intending. And I see this as basically a very real politic, and that the gas used perhaps on both sides, perhaps not. These concussion explosions that these fuel air, they're called a mini nuke in some ways, actually is used to set off armaments in regions too, as well as burning all the air out of the atmosphere in a region. It's hard to imagine that can actually be done, but it's true. And not much discussed. So I just question this, and I think it's a real rush to this, and I think it's serving other purposes of Middle Eastern dynamics. And I've got a lot more to say, but I think that's enough for now. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for calling in, and that really does bring up Professor Hendrickson, the big, larger questions of exactly, first of all, what happened, but also who did it. And at the G20 summit today, we're seeing world leaders just flat out disagreeing. Of course, the Syrian government denies that they use chemical weapons, but the Russian President Vladimir Putin is also denying that the Syrians used chemical weapons. When it comes to when it comes to the discussion among members of Congress, is there a broad consensus that the Syrians are the ones using the chemical weapons?
My sense of the debate is that members of Congress are generally accepting of much of what Obama says, that the Syrian government is mostly at fault here for using chemical weapons. And some of the most legitimate reports, it seems to me, have come from the French group, the Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, that they've made the case that chemical weapons have also been used and by the government. Nonetheless, I agree with your caller's general point that this still needs to be debated. There is no rush on this, it seems to me, and members of Congress need to raise the kind of questions perhaps that your caller has brought up. There's been no direct attack on the United States. There's probably a limited threat to the United States. So because of that, this is a very debatable question, and it's not at all clear to me that a president could unilaterally use force in this case where we haven't been attacked, we're not threatened. Congress needs to debate this, and then they need to vote on this to determine whether or not force should be used.
And maybe this is also a good time to bring in our other guest, Fred Lawson, who teaches international relations and government at Mills College in Oakland, California. And Fred, welcome to Focus.
Yes, good morning. morning. Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to ask you also about this question of being sure who is using chemical weapons in Syria. Of course, our earlier caller just questioned whether it was actually a chemical weapon at all. But the other question being debated is who's doing it. And I'm wondering if that comes up to not just a matter of the Syrian government versus the rebels, but could some other faction or organization within the Syrian government act on its own without President Assad's permission? Or could some individual faction in the rebels have taken that sort of action?
I think your caller does make an important point. The first point the caller made was that whatever happened in the suburbs of Damascus does not show classic signs of sarin gas. In fact, doesn't show classic symptoms of any particular chemical agent that we know the Syrian government has. Now, it's possible that there was a cocktail. It's possible that there was a mix of gases that somehow is giving off unusual symptoms, unusual reactions. But nevertheless, one wonders exactly which agent might have been released, which then leads to the question of how the agents got released. It does sound like the Obama administration is assuming that President Bashar al-Assad gave a direct order, that the military carried out a direct order, and therefore the government of Syria launched the nuclear weapons and carried out the attack. That is possible, but it sounds unlikely to me. Another possibility might be that some powerful rival, some powerful member inside the regime, issued orders to carry out the attack, partly as a way of leaving President al-Assad dumbfounded, making it impossible for President al-Assad to go ahead with negotiations, making it impossible for this Geneva peace conference to take place. So one could imagine that there are hardliners inside the regime that are largely responsible for the attack. And sure enough, there were reports pretty early on that the president's younger brother, General Maher al-Assad, may have given the orders, may have been behind the use of chemical weapons. He's consistently adopted a very hard line toward the uprising. I could even imagine a third possibility. I could imagine a third possibility that some commander on the ground launched a missile or two in the heat of battle, in the heat of the moment. Now, this does sound unlikely because the Syrian armed forces has been pretty strictly commanded. The command structure is pretty authoritarian. But the Syrian armed forces have been fighting a fierce battle for the last 2.5 years, and we could imagine, I think, command and control having been degraded just a little bit. The sobering thought about this third possibility is, if there is any chance that the Syrian command structure is fragile, Syrian command structure is breaking down, then one wonders what it would mean if the United States and French armed forces launch attacks that decapitate the Syrian armed forces. Because if local commanders even have the possibility of using non-conventional weapons, then a strike at command structures might have disastrous consequences.
So it sounds like for the sort of attack that the Obama administration is proposing, assuming that it can be done successfully, for it to have a useful effect in their view, then it has to be true that President Assad ordered these chemical weapons and therefore some action would discourage him from doing so.
That's how it seems to me. It seems to me that if any other line of causation were present, then a U.S. attack would be very much counterproductive. And I agree with Professor Hendrickson that it looks very much like members of Congress have taken it as a fact, have taken it as true, that President al-Assad did order the attack. And sure enough, that's the cleanest story. That's the story that makes retaliation, puts retaliation on the United States' part in the best light.
Let's take a little break right now, and we'll be back for more discussion on Syria from both the congressional point of view as they try to work out whether they want to support this, and also some more insight as to what's going on in the Mideast. This is Focus on WYLL. This is Focus on WYLL. We are back talking about Syria and the Obama administration's proposal for military action in Syria to in response to the use of chemical weapons there. Our guests are Ryan Hendrickson, professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, and Fred Lawson, who teaches international relations and government at Mills College in Oakland, California. Going on from here, Mr. Lawson, I was wondering, why does the Obama administration care so much about this action in Syria? Is it really about the Geneva Protocols that Syria signed in the 1920s? Is it really about chemical weapons? Would they be this concerned if it was some other country, or is it about Syria?
Syria does stand right in the heart of the Arab world. Syria shares an important border with the State of Israel. Syria is an element of the security concerns of Turkey and Iraq on both sides. So Syria is a little bit hard to ignore in strategic terms. But I do think that the charges about nuclear weapons, the charges about mass indiscriminate killing of civilians, makes a big difference in this particular case. The United States was willing to stand aside. The United States did almost nothing to supply the various militias and gave only half-hearted support to the major opposition groups prior to this time. The president, even when he first talked about his red line, was very careful to say that it would require lots of chemical weapons, that it would require a large-scale example of an atrocity before the U.S. would get involved. So I think the United States is very hesitant to get engaged here, and probably this action that looks like it challenges international norms, that looks like it's a humanitarian problem, is something that would push this particular president into thinking about action. And notice how long things are being dragged out, even in this case.
And Professor Hendrickson, I'm wondering, is Congress seeing it the same way from as far as you're able to ascertain? Do they have this same understanding of Syria as being an important player in the Mideast?
I think those who are speaking out about it right now largely would agree with the summary that Professor Lawson has just provided regarding the importance of Syria. But I would really emphasize the red line dynamic that was drawn by the president. I mean, by most accounts, it looks as if the red line has now been crossed. And Obama then is in a very difficult political situation. He's also getting pressure from some members of Congress to take action. So I think that's another part of this process that helped drive the president to decide, well, I may have to use force. Another thing is that, you know, he's got new advisors here, and his national security advisor, Dr. Susan Rice, who we're really not hearing too much about, but historically she's been a very kind of pro-human rights supporter. She was very strongly in favor of the use of force in Libya when she was U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and now she's national security advisor, which is the president's sort of closest confidant when it comes to national security affairs. So I think the pressure within his administration also is quite strong for a military response in this case.
Let me give out the phone number again for your comments or questions for our guests. And the number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL. You can email us at WYLL-talk, will-talk, at illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. I want to go to some area members of Congress who are not very enthusiastic about going into Syria at all, although I think they are leaving themselves a back door to change their minds if conditions are right. Both Rodney Davis and John Shimkus have issued statements saying that they just don't see enough things happening there. Rodney Davis says he has, in short, on his Facebook page, he writes that, "I do not believe that the president or his administration have made the case for military action in Syria. I also believe that the proposed request for authority is too broadly written, as it does not provide for a precisely defined strategy in Syria, and that if the president wants the support of Congress and the American people, he must lay out a compelling case and convince all of us why it is important for military action in Syria." Congressman John Shimkus has also issued a statement along similar lines. He is concerned about the lack of global support, support in the United Nations, support in the Arab League. And he does put it in the context, as we'll hear in this piece of audio, in the context of where we've been in the Mideast in the past decade.
We don't really have a true mission. And having been through these processes before, who would have thought we'd be in Afghanistan 12 years after we gave the president authority to use force? And I think the Iraqi experience is one that a lot of us still struggle with. Weapons of mass destruction, the international community agreed that there was there, and then nothing. A lot of blood and treasure spent for and not making the places any more secure.
And in his statement, Congressman Shimkus writes, "Until I see evidence of a real threat against the United States or our allies, or unless the international community reaches a consensus and leads, I am not convinced that a limited strike against Syria at this time is warranted." Professor Hendrickson, is that the sort of thing that that a lot of members of Congress who are not on board with this are saying?
Yes, that's right. And Shimkus, you know, he raises some especially legitimate points that, you know, the amount of international support for these potentially forthcoming strikes is incredibly limited. I mean, there's no UN approval, there's no NATO approval, there's no Arab League approval. Pretty much it's France and Turkey. Now, Secretary of State Kerry the other day mentioned that there's some other states who are supportive, but it's really France and Turkey. So that's problematic, and it's especially problematic because when presidents later then seek help from other states in the world, much of their help is conditioned upon previous multilateral approval. So entering a use of force without at least some kind of coalition is really politically and diplomatically risky for President Obama.
And may I say, too, please, that the question of strategy really is a crucial one. What kind of strategy the Obama administration adopts here on the ground? The Obama administration is trying to walk a very fine line, a fine line that inflicts severe punishment on the regime, but yet does not weaken or destabilize the regime. So the president keeps talking about this strike as not being targeted toward regime change, but yet doing something serious enough that'll catch the president's attention, President al-Assad's attention, and deter the regime from ever launching weapons again. A little hard to figure out what kind of targets, what kind of strikes could accomplish both of those things.
I want to take another caller now, and line four, this is Creel in Champaign. Good morning, you're on Focus.
Good morning. Your guest seems to say, take all the time you need to really study this issue. But is that possibly giving whoever did this time to do it again? I have children, including a six-year-old. Unfortunately, I can imagine him writhing as he suffocates to death. There have been times in our history where we have turned a blind eye to when enemies kill the children of their enemies. And these are times we have not been proud of as a country. Could you please have them address just the moral issue and the fact that if we turn a blind eye, are we setting a precedent? Are we saying, as long as it's not in our country, it's okay for somebody to suffocate children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Fred, maybe I could talk to you with your with your background in Syria. Well, first of all, of course, we know that there are real victims here, despite all the questions about exactly who did this. We know who the victims are. In the patchwork of who's in and out with the Assad government, whose children were killed in these attacks?
Yeah, no, right. The caller makes a really crucial point, and I'm not sure that I was saying that we need more time to think about things, but I think we need to think as carefully as we possibly can. I trust that the people in the administration are getting the very best advice they possibly can, because my primary concern is that if the administration is correct and the president himself ordered the strikes and it was a direct consequence of regime military action, then fair enough. And the punishment, the deterrence, perhaps should have come even more quickly than it has. But if a different pattern of causation happened, then a U.S. strike might make the regime even more vulnerable than it is now, might make the regime even make it harder for the regime to carry out command and control than it did now. And in fact, a U.S. attack may then precipitate even more use of chemical weapons in the future that could have been prevented if the chain of causation were different. So I'm just trusting that there's some sort of secret information that we don't know about, signals intelligence, eavesdropping of telephones, that shows that President al-Assad actually himself gave the order. Because if not, a U.S. strike could increase the likelihood of chemical weapons being used again.
The victims in those attacks, are they among the groups in Syria that would be on the losers on the loser side, on the other side from the Assad regime?
You know, I think we just plain don't know. These were residents of a couple of suburbs of Damascus that have been under the control of opposition groups for many, many months, and they were clearly all different kinds of people, young, old, men, women, so the attacks do look indiscriminate. Even though some people at first claimed that the film might have been staged, that this might be propaganda of some sort, I don't think anyone believes that right at the moment. I was sort of hoping that someone would come up at some point with an artillery shell or with a bomb, a piece of a bomb, that actually had a chemical agent on it. It would still be awfully nice to know that this was that the deaths were a direct result of something that the Syrian armed forces directly did.
Now, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, I guess, would be a kindred spirit for our last caller. Unlike Congressman Davis and Congressman Shimkus, he's an Illinois Republican who is supportive of going into Syria. Let's hear a little piece of audio from him.
I also am war-weary, as many Americans are war-weary. But I want to remind Americans of what one of my favorite presidents, Ronald Reagan, said. If we want to avoid war, he said, war begins when governments believe that the price of aggression is cheap. And I think that's a situation we find ourselves in Syria now. In fact, in listening to some of my colleagues, it's been amazing to me that we are seeming to paralyze ourselves into inaction, running through every potential scenario that could occur in this. And it makes me wonder, God help us if we become a country that can't do the right thing because we paralyze ourselves to inaction.
And that's Adam Kinzinger, whose district is a little north of both Rodney Davis and John Shimkus.
I think that comment reflects a long-time orientation that the United States has toward the world. In the lead-up to the Second World War, that orientation tended to be called Stimsonianism, related to Secretary of State Stimson. That is, any attack, any threat, any problem in other parts of the world may well pose a threat to the homeland of the United States, and therefore aggression has to be stopped early dangers facing the international community have to be stopped early, and it's the United States' primary responsibility to take the lead.
And that makes me think of the that sounds like that's the root of the so-called policeman of the world idea, that the United States can play this role in world affairs. Is that idea being discussed directly, Professor Hendrickson, in Congress now?
Well, members of Congress hate that phrase, the world policeman, and they use it oftentimes in the case when they're criticizing a president, saying, well, look, President, you know, we don't have to do everything in the world. But the flip side of the argument is that, well, maybe the United States, as the world's arguably most powerful country with the capabilities and resources to respond to these acts of aggression, maybe there is a responsibility, like your caller argues. My concern is that it should be still deliberated. And as we know, in the lead-up to the war in Iraq, you know, the two central arguments for war, that Saddam Hussein was connected to al-Qaeda and that Saddam Hussein had, you know, nuclear weapons, they just proved to be wrong, and that was the central reasons for going to war. So, and as Professor Lawson says, perhaps a strike could have even worse consequences. It may be right to use force, but I argue let's deliberate it, and I argue that that's appropriate, the appropriate checks and balances idea of American government.
Mr. Lawson, I'm wondering, where do other Mideastern countries stand on taking action, on anyone taking action in Syria at this time?
For the most part, the various surrounding countries, the Arab countries, even Iran, are sticking to the principle of non-interference in domestic affairs, to the principle of national self-determination, and instinctively reject the idea that any foreign power should come into the region, should try to influence the way that domestic conflict takes place in any particular country. It's intriguing to watch how Turkey, the phases that Turkey has gone through over the last few years. Turkey and Syria had good, close relations in the early 2000s, economic relations, even strategic relations. When the uprising first broke out, the Turkish prime minister got on the telephone, tried to persuade President al-Assad to carry out some reforms, to listen seriously to the protesters. The Turkish government thought it could be an intermediary, maybe, between the opposition and the government. And after the uprising was met with brutal force, the Turks pulled quite a bit away and changed their posture 180 degrees. So Turkey is now quite firmly opposed to Syria. At one point was calling for military intervention in Syria. My sense is that as the United States started to mobilize to actually do something, the Turks have been pulling back just a little bit. And partly the Turks have been pulling back because of the dramatic rise of the Kurdish nationalist movement inside Syria. And I think now the Turks are worried that if the Assad regime gets destabilized or gets overturned, that Turkey will then find itself facing a strategic threat from a well-armed, mobilized Kurdish movement right along the border.
And we're just getting into about the last couple of minutes of the program, and I'm apologize to Dave from Urban. I don't have time to take the call, but he does raise a point, I understand, about other countries besides Mideast countries and besides the U.S., even besides France, a former colonizer of Syria, that have interests here. Dave points, he says, that the Russians have the only naval bases in Syria. Is that accurate, and what are their concerns there?
That is accurate, but it's a bit of an overstatement to call it a base. There is a pier in the port of Tartus where the Soviets set up military supplies, and after the Soviet Union disappeared, the Russians kept it going for a little while, but much of that equipment got taken out about 13 months ago. There was a report this morning, though, that another large Russian warship is going to steam out of the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, and the Russians are putting together quite a large fleet just off the coast of Syria.
And Professor Hendrickson, if I could just bring the last word over to you, if you could bring up any point of what do you think is most important for members of Congress to keep in mind as they make a decision in the next week or two.
Well, they need to evaluate all the evidence. They need to attend the classified briefings, and they need to openly deliberate on this. I think that when President Obama makes his public case, it appears now it's going to be on Tuesday night, that will probably help make the case for a use of force. And if you've noticed, all the congressional leadership, whether it's Republican or Democrat, has said that they are willing to authorize military action.
Including Senator McConnell? Is he out there too?
McConnell, I think he still may be on the wavering on this, but Harry Reid has said yes. Nancy Pelosi in the House has said yes. Boehner has said yes. Eric Cantor, all the leadership is pretty much on board. So I suspect that it's likely they'll authorize force. When, I'm not sure, but I think that's likely how this will play out, and it tends to be the way that Congress acts historically. When it comes to military action abroad, they tend to defer to the president, and they go with the president.
Well, that's all the time we have now. I always hope when we have shows like this that we'll tie everything up in a nice bow at the end. That never happens, but all the same, thank you very much to political science professor Ryan Hendrickson of Eastern Illinois University and Fred Lawson, who teaches international relations and government at Mills College in Oakland. And our thanks also to Juana Summers of Political, who was with us earlier on the show. Monday on Focus, not the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll be talking about the Illinois Supreme Court as it prepares to consider cases this fall. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows on WILL.